welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, November 11th, 2015. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And my guests today are novelists Nina Revoir and Catherine Taylor, who have written novels that take place in Southern California and very much capture different areas and aspects of Southern California on the page. First up is Nina Revoir, but before I bring her on, I need to talk about our fund drive. We are in our fund drive, our fall fund drive again, and we need to do this every year because it's how we keep the lights on, how we keep the water cooler full of water. The university counts on us to bring in funds, and so we turn to you, our listeners. If you ever listen to the show, we would love you to call 824-5824. That's area code 949-824-5824. And we need to generate $10,000 in the next couple of weeks. And the only way we can do that is with your help. Nicole has joined me in the studio here. She's on the phones today, along with a couple of other KUCI people. How's it going out there?
Hi there, Barbara. Well, we're excited. We're looking forward to talking to listeners and taking their pledges. We, of course, appreciate donations at any level. The pledge level officially starts at $35. And for that, you're a KUCI fan. And you can get a cool KUCI t-shirt or mug or sports bottle or tote bag, or be very happy to talk about those premiums with anyone who calls.
Plus, we also take humble donations. $5 shows that you like the show, that you listen, that you support us, because sometimes we don't know who's listening. We don't do demographic studies. We're such a low budget station, university station, that your donations tell us that you listen. So anything will help. And thanks, Nicole.
Yeah. See you later, Barbara. Okay. Have a good show.
Anyway, I'm going to bring on Nina Revoir. I first want to introduce her to you. I've known of her work for a few years. She's been on the show before. She's the author of four previous novels, including The Age of Dreaming, which was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, Southland, a Los Angeles Times bestseller and best book of 2003, and Wing Shooters, which won an ABA Indies Choice Book Award and was selected by O, the Oprah Magazine, as one of 10 titles to pick up now. Nina lives and works in Los Angeles, and she's here primarily today to talk about Lost Canyon, published by Akashic. Hi, Nina.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, I'm so glad to have you on. Let's start by you talking about Lost Canyon. Did I call it Lost Horizon?
No. You got it right.
I keep thinking Lost Horizon for some reason. Talk about Lost Canyon and how it came about.
Well, Lost Canyon is basically an adventure gone wrong, and it involves four very different people from diverse backgrounds, different parts of Los Angeles, who go on a backpacking trip into the Sierra Nevada. It's supposed to be just a mellow, you know, few days of relaxation and recharging, and they run into a couple of different sets of bad guys, end up having to make some choices and run for their lives. So the book really came into being for a couple reasons, and the first is my just absolute love of the mountains. I am an avid hiker and backpacker. I came late to this passion, you know, not until my 30s, kind of like these characters who themselves are in their late 30s, early 40s. And I just really wanted to capture both the grandeur of being out in the wilderness, but also some of the fear of being out in the wilderness. So that was one side of things. And the other is that I really wanted to reflect the Los Angeles that I knew. and the parts of Los Angeles that I know, that places like Watts, places like Highland Park or Glassell Park, two characters are from those places, and then one of them is from Brentwood. But some of these areas often aren't presented in fiction, and definitely not in a loving way. So I wanted to capture both my love of the city as well as my love of the wilderness.
Well, I was curious because I think I knew that about you. Maybe it came with the press materials about hiking, your love of hiking and being out there. But at the same time, I'm curious if you took notes. Do you take notes when you're out there so you can draw from them?
Absolutely. And it's not that I necessarily go out and, you know, for the purpose of taking notes. You know, I don't go out there for any purpose other than I just love to be out and experiencing the beauty. I love the physical challenge of being in the mountains and, you know, the sense of having to be really present, you know, in your body and in the moment to deal with particularly anything, you know, particularly threatening or challenging or uncertain. And so, you know, that's why I go out there. But while I'm out there, I notice things. You know, I notice what a tree looks like. I notice what a vista looks like. So I might jot down a comparison, an image, something that comes to mind just on my, you know, on a piece of paper, but I don't necessarily do anything with it. It's more just kind of like a recording. It's almost a verbal, you know, photograph taking. And then when I come home, I'll have a pile of notes that may or may not be incorporated into what I'm writing. And certainly with this book, a lot of those notes that were taken on mountain climbs or backpacking trips did make it into the book.
Hmm. Well, as you said, you have four main characters, but only three are point of view characters. And as I was reading, I kept waiting for the fourth, for Tracy to come in, and we never go into her point of view. And when I reached the end of the book without giving it away, I wondered if you had the ending in mind from the beginning, in which case she could not be a point of view character.
You know, I didn't. Each of these characters, there's four very different characters. One is Todd, who is a white attorney who works in Brentwood, but has a, you know, he's doing very well for himself financially, but his family life is a little bit empty, and he feels disconnected from his more modest blue-collar Wisconsin roots. Another character is Oscar, who's a Latino real estate agent who's really contributed to the gentrification of Highland Park. Gwen, who's an African-American youth counselor who works in Watts, and then Tracy, who you mentioned, who's the trainer and the leader of the trip, who shares my own racial mix. She's Japanese and white. And she's the one who doesn't have the point of view. And a large part of that is that I didn't think that Tracy doesn't have the same level of introspection that the other characters do. She's the gung-ho person. She's the person who kind of leads people to you know, to pull the most out of themselves, but also maybe leads them. She's a little reckless, and so she leads them into danger. And because I didn't think that she was going to have the same kind of inner life that the others did, that was a large part of why I didn't give her a voice, in a way. And but no, I didn't have. I knew that the characters were going to run into some, you know, some tough situations, and there was going to be mortal danger. But I didn't know what the ending was going to be. That evolved as I went through the book.
Interesting. Well, I'd love to hear you read from Lost Canyon. Would you?
Sure. And this is from about 2/3 of the way through the book. This is after the character's trip, which had started out quite idyllic-ly. Then it takes a, they run into, essentially into men with guns that have to do with some pretty scary groups, and they're now running for their lives. And so this is a little bit later, and I'm reading this section because it gives you a little bit of sense, both of the adrenaline that they're dealing with, but also what the mountains look and feel like in the Sierras.
Okay.
They marched on without talking. The ground was nearly level. They were moving through the bottom of the valley. A bright blue Stellar's Jay shot through a cluster of trees, turning sideways and touching each trunk lightly with its feet, like a skier running a slalom course. They passed a tree with a giant mushroom growing out of its side, like a white fleshy ear turned downward to hear messages from the ground. Then Todd stopped to point out a clump of coarse black hair stuck on the side of a tree. "Look," he said. "A bear used this tree to scratch his back." Oscar squinted at the hair and shivered. "Wow, he must have been a big one." "Is there any other kind?" Gwen said. "Let's keep moving." They kept walking, a bit faster, and then suddenly they were out of the woods. It was lighter now, almost 7 a.m. The peaks on either side of them were lit orange and gold in the early morning sun. They were flanked by huge boulder fields, amazingly white, like giant snowballs that had rolled downhill. Beyond them, at the end of the valley, massive spires and sharp pinnacles with sheets of snow draped between them extended thousands of feet into the sky. Todd's heart lifted, despite everything. He'd never seen such grandeur. He looked again at the corridor between the turrets and pinnacles, which framed the valley all the way to its end. It was like strolling down an avenue lined with cathedrals. It was like walking into the arms of God. Directly in front of them was a basin they had seen from the top, but what had looked like a small break in the trees now revealed itself to be a bigger open space. It was probably a mile across, maybe more. The land was uneven, patches of green and brown interspersed with slabs of granite. In the middle of it all was the lake. A small stream fed into it and then flowed out the other side. This, in turn, Todd knew, would eventually lead to other water, one of the countless rivers that rose up in California and flowed all the way to the sea. "Well, there's our water," he said. "Yeah, good," Gwen said. "But look at those mountains." Now Todd looked up ahead of them and saw why Gwen was worried. He'd been so focused on the beauty around him that he hadn't thought about what awaited when they got to the valley's end. From the ridge, the peaks to the east had looked formidable, but distant. From here, he could see the full scope of them. The range they had to cross was massive, a jagged spine of sharp, barren peaks, easily over 13,000 feet. But he was still overcome by a sense of awe and a sudden understanding of the land. The Western Sierra built gradually, with gentle foothills and lush valleys and hospitable forests. Now they were approaching the starker Eastern Sierra, where one plate of the earth had pushed under another and thrust the mountains into the sky.
Thank you so much. That was Nina Revor reading from Lost Canyon, published by Akashic. I want to remind all of you that we're in the midst of a fund drive, and if you want to support the show, please call 949-824-5824. You can go online to kuci.org and donate there and indicate that you listen to Writers on Writing. And you can do that anytime, not just during this hour. But hopefully we'll hear from a bunch of you and know that you listen and support Writers on Writing. So, Nina, I love that section. And I, you know, throughout the book, setting figures so highly throughout Lost Canyon. There's so much setting, but never too much. Of course, it made me want to hike that area, and I actually went to Google Maps and tried to find where you were writing about. I'm not sure I did, but whether it was totally fictional or if it actually exists there, you know, east of Bakersfield. But I wonder if you could talk a bit about setting and how you write it to get it just right.
Well, to answer the second part of that, Lost Canyon, the setting of this book is fictional, and it's a kind of a greatest hits compilation of places that I've been in the Sierra. So even in that little bit that I read, you know, to your earlier points, some of those images, the blue jay or the snowballs that have, you know, rolled downhill, those were all things that I noted during different hikes, actually in very different parts of the Sierra. But I would just, you know, kind of put them all together to create this fictional area. There are actually two places in the Sierra called Lost Canyon,
mm-hmm.
and I just love the name.
Yeah.
You know, there's just the romanticism of it, the mystery, and that's it, it's kind of the Sierra is full of really strange, fun place names. You know, Dead Horse Canyon. Dead Man Canyon, you know, and Hell for Sure Pass, things like that, which I think are just so much fun and full of Hungry Packer Lake, which is a real lake. So in terms of creating the setting, one of the things that I was trying to do was there's a very fine balance between putting in enough description to really give you a sense of where you are, and that's whether it's in the mountains or in the city. But you also don't want to have so much description that it just becomes, you know, too much, that it distracts from the character or from the story. And so that's something that I really was paying attention to. How do I put in just enough to place the reader, but not enough to overwhelm the reader? And for that, it was just a matter of trying to work on it, trying to make sure that people could envision where these characters were. And then, of course, looking at models. And one of the real models for this book was James Dickey's wonderful classic novel, Deliverance.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't seen the movie, which I know is also classic. But for the book, it's just a tremendously, it's a gorgeous book, you know, both in terms of the characterization, but also in terms of the writing and description. And it's striking to read that book and realize just how much description there is in it, but you almost don't notice it because the story is moving along so fast. And he struck that perfect balance of really placing you so that you could see and feel and hear the river, but never slowing things down, you know, that things are always moving forward with this great momentum. And so that's also what I was trying to do.
Did you have to leave much out?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. And I, a big part of the editing this book was paring it down. And to give props to someone very local to you, Ron Carlson,
mm-hmm.
I had actually, I thought, finished Lost Canyon. And then I read his book, The Signal. And I saw in reading that book how spare his language was, you know, how kind of economical, that there was nothing that wasn't necessary. And so once I read The Signal, it made me go back to my own manuscript with a very different eye. And I cut about 60 or 70 pages from what I thought was the final draft, largely because of the lessons I learned just from reading Ron Carlson.
Interesting. Okay. And he has a blurb on the front of your book, too, which is pretty wonderful.
I can't even describe what a thrill that was, because mm-hmm. I just knew this was the person that I most, you know, wanted to have kind of on the front of the book, and also, you know, let's be real, adventure books, survival books are such a male kind of, you know, terrain, and the importance of having, you know, so in this book, it was important for me to put women in the adventure, in the
mm-hmm.
survival. It was important for me to have a diverse cast of characters. And so, you know, having this tremendous kind of endorsement from Ron Carlson, as well as from, you know, just other writers that I deeply admire, Janet Fitch, who writes about Los Angeles so amazingly, and Tiare Jones, who writes about, you know, everything, America and race and people and women and families. You know, it was just, I feel so fortunate to have all of them supporting this book.
Hmm. Yeah, it's, it was quite a page-turner, Lost Canyon was. And as I was reading it, because it doesn't start out like your typical suspense novel or thriller. Whether there is a typical, I don't know. I read across genres, so I don't know if it, you know, fits typically into any genre really. But as I was reading and caught up in it, I began to wonder what genre you considered it to be in and how you felt about categories.
Well, you know, that's a great question. And in several of my books, I play with elements of genre. You know, I definitely consider this a literary novel, but it's really in the adventure survival vein. And so I've already talked about Deliverance, which I think is the classic adventure novel. And you know, so James Dickey was a definite influence on this book, but so was James Baldwin. You know, with my concerns about race, my concerns about social issues, and part of the fun of this was combining two different types of books that don't normally go together, you know, the adventure survival novel with a book that deals with racial and social concerns. So I wasn't, you know, one of the things that's wonderful about genre is that there's still such an attention and a focus on story. And I think that for me, the characterization, and when you're saying the book doesn't read like a conventional thriller, I think that's what you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
that the first third of it is really setting up each of these characters, giving them the backstory, placing them within their different parts of Los Angeles, you know, in Watts and in Highland Park, LaSalle Park, and in Brentwood, you know, really giving the why of why they're going on this trip in the first place, and paying attention to that level of characterization and story. So that's something that I was trying to do. But I also really care about plot and about narrative. You know, we as humans want stories. We want to be pulled along. We want to know what happens next. And so no matter what I'm doing, whether it's a book that borrows from the survival and adventure genre, or from the noir genre, as a couple of my other books have, or they don't have anything that seems like genre, I still want there to be a compelling enough story that people want to know what happens next.
Mm. Well, yeah, you know, setting up your characters from the start, the way you did it, gave me a lot of hope, I think, for sort of writing across genre, because, you know, it started, we really did get to know the characters, and I thought, well, this is like, you know, this is like a literary novel where we're going into character, and it's important, and it's not important to jump right into what happened or, you know, the horrible thing the characters have to get through. And then as they, you know, get into their hike, how things start transpiring, how things start going wrong. And were you concerned when you were writing it that it was too slow at the beginning? I didn't find it slow, but I could see as a writer who is perhaps writing a literary thriller that you might think, well, there's too much about character. There's, you know, maybe I need to get right into it.
I wouldn't say I was concerned, but I was, and again, you know, looking at that Deliverance, the two things that I love that book. I can't state strongly enough how much I love that book, and I've read it a number of times. The two things that struck me were, again, that you know, most adventure survival books are about a particular demographic, you know, and I wanted to create a book that was more reflective of the city and the world as I know it. And so that was one kind of point of difference. And the other was that I wanted to know more about those characters. You know, Dickie did a terrific job of painting their personality types, but, you know, I wanted to know what drove, other than the narrator, I wanted to know what drove the others to be there. What are their stories? What are their motivations? And so that's something that I was mindful of in really trying to create my own. And again, because these folks are coming from such different backgrounds, such different experiences, I can't assume that readers are going to understand the issues around gentrification and race relations in Northeast LA, or what it's like for a blue-collar white guy from Wisconsin to become a wealthy lawyer and all that entails, or what it's like for a young black woman who is working in Watts, or the kinds of issues she's dealing with youth there and the challenges. So I really needed to paint those stories a little bit in those characters so you understood who they were and what had gone into their making before I sent them off into this adventure.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. We have a few minutes left, and I wonder if you could spend a little time talking about what has changed, perhaps, in your writing process. You have four previous novels, and I'm curious if, after writing four and now a fifth, if your confidence level changes, or does plot come more easily, or, you know, what has happened, you know, sort of along the way? What has changed?
You know, each time it's totally new. Each time it's starting over, and there's no predictable way that a book is going to come together. You know, my last book, my prior book, Wing Shooters, is something, even though it's my shortest book, it's only about 200 pages, it took the longest time to come together. I'd written a short story in college, I wrote a little bit more after that, but it didn't really come together until my late 30s, you know, and so the span of time it took to write that book was really 20 years, you know, and I was working on it between all the others, whereas Lost Canyon just kind of came out. You know, and the first draft came out quickly. The book was written in a couple of years, 2-3 years, and for me, that's fast. But that came on the heels of having spent 2 years on another book that is now in a drawer that I realized wasn't working and set aside. And so I think one thing that has changed for me is that I roll with the punches more easily. You know, if I'm doing something like working on another story or another book for 2 years and it's not working, I don't panic as I used to years ago, because I know that's part of the process. You know, failure, recognizing what's not working, setting it aside and maybe veering another direction is part of the process for me, and I no longer, you know, think that the world is over if my particular project at that moment isn't coming together.
Interesting. Well, as I said, I loved Lost Canyon, and I would love to talk to you more. Perhaps we'll have you down here at the speaker series in the new year, and so we can talk more. And I've ordered your other books, and I really look forward to reading more by you. And thank you so very much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. That was Nina Revor. Her book is Lost Canyon, published by Akashic. And it really is a page-turner. I think I read it in 2 days, maybe. So, anyway. When we come back, actually, I don't think we're going to go anywhere unless I do a little musical interlude. I'm going to talk about our fun drive, but in the second half of the show, we'll have on Catherine Taylor, who wrote another Southern California novel, Valley Fever, which isn't about the valley you might think it is about. But in the meantime, before we bring her on, I want to talk about the fun drive we have going on right now. And the phones are so silent. And if you're thinking about calling, about donating, this is a great time to do it. Between guests, 949-824-5824. Every year, every season that we have this fun drive, I always wonder if people are listening. And when the phone doesn't ring, I think nobody's listening. And I know that's not true because a lot of you go online to KUCI.org and donate. But I just want to tell you what your donation does for us. It pays our phone bills. It keeps the lights on. It fills up the water cooler. We are in the middle of a fun drive, and we always look to those listeners who listen week after week. And even if you tune in once in a while or you listen to podcasts, all of the shows and all of the podcasts occur because there's a station here. And the station is here because of our loyal supporters who listen to the various shows. We have many public affairs shows, and music is on all the time when public affairs shows are not, which is most of the time, alternate or alternative music that you can't really find on other stations, especially in Orange County. So we do offer premiums. I think $35 is the lowest premium level, although you could donate $5 and be dear to me forever because you're showing that you listen. The number is 949-824-5824, or go online to KUCI.org and just indicate that you listen to Writers on Writing, and eventually we'll learn of your donation and that you helped keep us on the air. Okay, we have time for a little bit of music. I'm going to put on more Wes Montgomery. And when we come back, we will have Catherine Taylor. Stay with us. Welcome back to the show. I'm here with Nicole and
hi, Barbara.
And we want to talk about the fun drive for a few more minutes. What do you think, Nicole?
I think it's an exciting day. It's the one day, I believe, that Writers on Writing is on this year in the fall fun drive. It's 949-824-5824. We'd love to talk to you and take your pledge in any amount. We really appreciate it and help show your support for the station. This show has been on the air for a long time. Is it 18 years, Barbara?
I think it is 18 years. It began in a dorm room, and in I think in the closet of a dorm room. And I'm looking here. I think that sounds about right. And the first song. Do you know the first song?
I used to. Was it Sugar Sugar?
Oh, Sugar Sugar. Of course, you know, we would all be slain if we played that now here.
Who was? Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Who was your first guest when you did Writers on Writing the first time?
That's a good question. I don't know. I know one of the first, I think, was Billy Collins.
Oh, awesome.
But I think it was a poet who teaches here at UCI, and I forget his name. I forget his name, but that first year was really sort of touch and go with guests and feeling comfortable, and we recorded on tape cassettes then. And I don't know if there's even a slot. Yeah, there's a slot for a tape cassette. We could still play tape cassettes here. But who was your first guest?
Oh, I took baby steps. So I co-interviewed with you and Marie a few times. There was Mary Roach, was an early
Roach.
One. And I'm going to go answer
I
that
hear the phone.
949-824-5824. Talk to you later.
Okay. Thanks, Nicole. Anyway. So there you have it, and you are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and at the first half, we were here with Nina Revor with Lost Canyon. We're back with Catherine Taylor. She wrote Valley Fever, published by FSG. I'm going to bring her on. First, I want to tell you a little bit about her, and I need to find her bio so I can read it to you. And it simply says, Catherine Taylor is the author of Rules for Saying Goodbye. She lives in Los Angeles. She's really quite humble because if you go to her website, if you Google CatherineTaylor.com, you'll see, you know, a mass of book reviews. Her book was an Oprah selection, editor's pick, New York Times book review, so much. So I have a feeling we're going to be talking with a very humble author. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Barbara.
Really, your bio is so slim, and then you go to your website, and you know all the stuff. What's up?
I don't know. I didn't even want to have my photo in the back of the book. I just think that the book should stand on its own, and the author should be completely as absent as the author can possibly be.
So. Sure. Well, I understand that, but still. So let's talk about Valley Fever. What was the genesis for the novel?
The story is based on something that happened to friends of my parents when I was a child. It's something that has obsessed me since I was small. I've always been interested, I guess, in stories of friendship and how they evolve or devolve. And I think, you know, writers in general probably write about what obsesses them. And so at a certain moment, it became time in my life to write this story.
Hmm. You know, what first drew me to Valley Fever was a piece in the Los Angeles Times. It might have been early summer. It was an essay you wrote about the book. And as I recall, you were talking about having a deadline that either you couldn't make or you didn't want to make or you weren't really sure what was going to happen in the book. And your editor told you, go to Fresno and walk the fields.
The original deadline for this book was 2007. and then in 2009, I handed in a draft. I had worked on it for about 4 years, and I handed in a draft that was, my editor took me out to lunch and sat me down and said, you have to throw this out. She said, I want you to keep the story and the characters, but this voice is not working. And I was consciously and very self-consciously trying to get away from the voice in my first novel. I didn't want to write the same book, is what I told my editor. And she sort of shook her head and said, you will never write the same book. And I was very conscious of sort of showing everyone what I could do. And what I could not do was a really false, cold, distant, third-person voice. And so she said, start over. I said, well, what is working in the book? And she said, no, I could point out sentences that are working, but I don't want you to start from anything in this draft. You must completely start over. So in 2009, I started over completely. And I finally nailed the voice. But then I was having trouble with the story. And I phoned her and said, you know, about a year later, I phoned her and said, this is the book I have to throw out. You know, I'm just having too much trouble with it. I need to move on from this book now. And she said, absolutely not. You need to place Ingrid, who's the protagonist, you need to place Ingrid on the farm. I had been telling the story, I had been structuring it kind of like in a Great Gatsby kind of way where the narrator is telling the story and not directly involved in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And Ingrid needed to be involved in the story. I said to my editor, I didn't grow up on a farm. I would have to do so much research. And she said, of course, Catherine, do your research. So that was the piece I wrote in the LA Times. I got off that telephone. I drove directly up to Fresno. I was making calls from the car to my father and his golf friends, a lot of whom happened to be farmers. And they were absolutely wonderful to me and helped. There wouldn't be a book really if they hadn't been incredibly generous with their time and their knowledge, and really patient as well.
Do you think that, I understand, you know, nailing the voice, but I wonder if, could you have nailed the voice and gotten the story and all the details as visceral as they are now in the book if you hadn't gone there?
Absolutely not. It's a much, much different book now than it was when I called my editor in 2010 and told her I was giving up. It's a warmer book. It's a much more personal book. The narrator in my first novel is called Catherine Taylor, and people often ask, "Well, who do you feel close?" They're both first person narrators, and people often ask, "Who do you feel closer to?" And I think Ingrid is emotionally and psychologically, just I feel so much closer to her than I did to the Catherine Taylor of the first book. And I called her Catherine Taylor almost as a form of distance, because it's such a cliche that the your first novel should be so heavily based on one's life. But I feel close to Ingrid in a way that I didn't when I was willing to give the novel up, 5 years ago.
Hmm. Well, I loved Valley Fever, and I want to read your first novel, and I would love it if you would read to us from Valley Fever.
Okay, I'll read very briefly.
Okay.
Ingrid has suffered a quite devastating breakup that she should have seen coming, and it has left her not just emotionally in ruins, but also financially. She had left her former life, which we learned at the very, very beginning of the book is kind of a habit of hers. And her sister has now driven her home to their parents in Fresno because Ingrid has nowhere else to go. They arrive in Fresno and they discover that things are sort of disintegrating around them. That June, the peaches didn't grow. The leaves of the peach trees wilted and curled and sprung pits with no flesh. There were no fruit flies, no infestations of worms. That year, the peaches had been stunted by water-stressed trees and a fungus nothing seemed to kill. "But we're fine. You don't want to hear about us," Mother said. "Or do you want to hear?" "Yes, we do," I said. "You know, those peaches they get from South America are grown in human shit," Mother said. "We know about the South American peaches," I said. When I first moved to Los Angeles, the sewer in Howard's backyard had exploded. Months later, in that patch of grass to the side of the house where the toilet paper and feces and old tampons had come up, tomatoes appeared so plentiful, the vines so tall and abundant, I thought for a week the tomatoes were bougainvillea. Seeds must have made their way through the disposal. The vines grew up the side of the house and over the fence shared with the cranky neighbor. Those tomatoes were more delicious than even the ones my grandmother had grown. They were more delicious than any fruit I had eaten in years. don't get me started on the peaches from Georgia. Anne said, we know the peaches from Georgia, Mom. The peaches grown in Georgia, like most of the peaches grown in California, the years we could grow peaches, were grown for color and for cold storage endurance. They tasted like nothing, like wood pulp. Dad's peaches were yellowy-orange and didn't store very well, but they tasted the way a peach ought to taste, like sun and sugar. And Dad's peaches were so juicy, you had to eat them over a sink.
Hmm. Thank you so much. That was Catherine Taylor reading from Valley Fever. I must, of course, update you listeners about the fund drive. And Richard Reese, the wonderfully magnanimous and generous Richard Reese, called in to donate $100. And he said he will match pledges up to $500 until the end of the hour. So we have less than 20 minutes for this to happen. So please call 949-824-5824. If you donate $35, he will donate $35. And if you donate $100, he'll donate $100. Thank you, Richard. That is so generous. And KUCI surely needs the funds. So 949-824-5824. Catherine, I love the character, the parent characters, especially the mother, and there's so many compelling characters in this book. Are the parents based on anyone in particular?
No, all my characters are always sort of composite.
Uh-huh.
So there are little bits of different people here and there. My own mother, of course. You know, she saw herself in the mother in my last book because they had the same name, and this mother is a much more sinister character, and happily, my mother sees absolutely no resemblance between her and the mother in the book.
Mm-hmm. And George too, he was interesting, and of course, I kept waiting to find out what was going to happen with George and Ingrid. And where did he come about? Again, a composite.
I'm crazy about George too. He is a composite. He's a composite. Maybe I think physically I was thinking of my spouse when I was writing him, but he's a composite as well.
Earlier you talked about that it was important for you to nail the voice, and I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that, how you did it and how you knew you had it when you did.
That's a really good question. I didn't know that I had it. You know, I at that point I didn't know what I was doing. I just but how I did it was I couldn't allow myself to let that self-editor, that self-consciousness into my brain and stop me from doing what I naturally do. And so I thought, well, if I don't give myself any time, then the editor can't, you know, my self-editor can't come in and censor me. So it was the beginning of the summer when Courtney Hodel, who was my editor at the time, took me to lunch and said, dump the book. And so I went to my parents' summer house in Michigan, where they were also at the time, and I gave myself 2 months to come up with a draft. And most of the material in that draft I tossed. It was sort of, I guess what I wrote during those 2 months was the run-up to where the book begins.
Hmm.
I sort of wrote everything that happened to Ingrid. It was like 300 pages what happened to Ingrid before she ends up at the farm. And of course the book really begins when she gets to the farm. But what I got by forcing myself to write those 300 pages in two and a half months was that I couldn't think about too much about the voice. I had to write what came authentically to me. And I really didn't know. I had no idea how good or terrible it was. And I sent it off to Courtney, and she was the one who said, yes, now you have nailed the voice. And then, of course, she also said, however, this book begins when Ingrid gets to the farm. So it was like practice. Another thing I did was I went back and I read all the books. I read the books that have been my favorite for the past 10 years, the books where the voices are really, really strong, even when there's not even much of a story, but where the voice comes through. Ernest Hemingway's Immovable Feast and Joan Didion's Play It As It Lays. You know, it's like really the cliched writer books that everyone goes back to. Another one was Truman Capote's Breakfast at Tiffany's, and that's where the first paragraph comes from. In the first paragraph, Ingrid says she never returns to places she's lived. And in the first paragraph of Breakfast at Tiffany's, he says, "I'm always drawn back to the places where I've lived."
Mm.
I read that sentence and thought, "Who in the world is drawn back? I am so repelled by the places where I've lived that I will actually walk all the way around 73rd Street and 2nd Avenue so that I don't have to pass my old apartment."
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You know, you sound like a patient writer. I mean, if you're able to, you know, work for 2 months and write, you know, all those pages and throw them out because you are now at the beginning, that sounds like a great amount of patience that is such an advantage as a writer to have. Do you see it that way?
You know, I don't. I think what requires patience and discipline is really opening the mail and answering the phone and, you know, remembering to sort of pay bills and balance my bank account. That sort of the real life, the things of real life require patience. The work of writing, I hesitate to even use the word work because it doesn't feel like work. It feels very much like play to me. But the play of writing is, you know, I don't think it requires any patience at all. It's a shame that I have to write so much to get the part, to get to the meat of what I'm doing. But it's not work that's wasted. Because
so
it's stuff I have to do.
Yeah. So to get what you use, do you do other things? Do you do any sort of plotting or outlining or character biographies or anything else? Or does the writing take you there?
I am a total failure at all of that. I wish I could outline because I would probably save myself a lot of time and heartache. And I'm told by my friends who are successful outliners that it would save me a lot of time and heartache. But I have to be surprised on every page. That's what keeps me engaged. And when I have tried outlining, the work just sort of comes out completely dead. I am not a gifted outliner, and I have the whole world of the novel, and I have the characters in my head. And I guess what I end up doing is sort of character study. You know, that's the stuff that ends up getting thrown out, that ends up in the cut folder.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Immovable Feast, Play It As It Lays, Breakfast at Tiffany's. Is reading a way that you start your day or get into your story? Or once you're into your story, do you just stop reading other works?
Oh, I'm a constant reader. I'm a constant reader. I don't know that I read first thing in the morning. I do if I get up and I look at the page and I can't write anything. Then I go directly to whatever it is I'm reading.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big reader, and I draw inspiration from, you know, all sorts, and not just those strong voiced books. I did go back to when I was looking for my own. And it was reassuring to see that Hemingway and Joan Didion and Chekhov as well. I don't usually mention him because it's in translation, so you can't really tell. But all of these writers, they have the same voice throughout each of their books. That's what makes them the writers that they are. And that was something that I really hadn't considered when I was trying so hard to get away from my own voice.
So does your first novel have this voice? That's the Ingrid's voice or the narrator's voice in Valley Fever?
I think that all my work has to be my work.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to, the voice has to be. So I hope that you could open up each book without my name on the front and know that it's my stuff. But they're different characters, and so the voices are different. But I had been trying to sort of hammer the humor and the warmth out of out of the voice in my first novel, and that was, you know, what a silly thing to do.
Why were you doing that, do you think?
I think, like all writers, I think my first book was a little misread and misunderstood, and I was very self-conscious about being taken seriously, and I thought, well, if all you readers, and of course it wasn't all readers, but I think a few readers missed the coldness or the distance and the isolation, the loss that is built into the voice. And I thought, well, if you can't see that, then I'll just have to spell it out for you. And so what I ended up with was a very, very cold, distant, isolated, lost voice, which didn't work.
Yeah. Well, it's been just an absolute pleasure talking with you. I've loved Valley Fever, and I do want to read your previous work because you read a book by an author that you love, and you want to read everything that author has written. So I'm going to do that, and I wonder if, in closing, you could offer any advice or words of wisdom for the writers who are listening.
You know, off the top of my head, something very private. I'm at my desk at the moment, by the way, and my desk is sort of covered in stuff that, like I was saying, the real life stuff that I have to do that I find so very difficult. and that would be my advice. Like, do not let the practical things of life. Two things. Don't let them get in the way of what you're doing. Like, this is why things pile up on my desk, and then I always think of this phrase, ad un certo punto, that the Italians use. We don't really have one. We say the translation is at a certain moment, which I think is so funny. What is at a certain moment, you know? But now has come the certain moment that I really must pay my health insurance for you. Ignore the stuff of life. You have to allow yourself to be free to do the work. And also, I keep using the word work, and don't use that word either, or otherwise it may become work. It really is freedom and play, and you have to, you know, be a child and forget that you do have responsibility. It's a difficult thing for an adult to do, but it's absolutely necessary if you're going to be a writer.
Mm. Thank you so much, Catherine, for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Barbara, for having me.
Of course. That was Catherine Taylor. Her book is Valley Fever, published by FSG. And we'll see about having her down at the speaker series as well. Want to say a few more words about the fund drive. We just got a donation by a loyal listener, Cindy Cooksey. And until the end of the hour, we have 7 minutes. Richard Reese will match pledges up to $500. We have 7 minutes. So if you donate $5, we've got 10. So 949-824-5824 is the number you need to call. You have 6 minutes now. So 1969 was, we went on the air out of a dorm room, and it was Sugar Sugar by the Archies. It was November 25th, 1969, that we were granted our first official broadcast license, transmitting 10 watts at the original frequency of 89.9. And so many of our alumni have gone on to do other things. Nick Roman he served for nearly 20 years as news director at KLON, now KKJZ. In Long Beach, and he's currently senior news editor at KPCC and is a national public radio reporter, as well as many other alumni have gone on to work at other stations and for media outlets. So KUCI is a wonderful starting point for media journalists and DJs and people who want to be involved in radio. So we do need your help, and the most modest pledge tells us that you're listening and that you care about the show and would love to see Writers on Writing continue. 949-824-5824. I'm going to leave you now, and I'm going to put more Wes Montgomery on This show, along with hundreds of other shows, are up on penonfire.com. No charge. You can listen anytime. You can have your own personal MFA program by listening to this show. So I do hope you'll call 949-824-5824. We have 4 minutes that Richard Reese will match. Oh, wait. Here comes another one. Tani Trost donated. Tani, she has the show before ours. What would Arwen do? And Nicole Nelson, our co-host, she even donated, and she works here. Okay, so that's how it goes here. We'll all donate, those of us who work here, to keep the show on the air. So we hope you do too. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you here next week.